You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 27th of February to the 5th of March. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy features editor Paul Jump and reporter David Matthews. The government is considering relaxing post-study work rules for overseas students, at least at research-intensive universities. Music to their ears, no doubt. We'll hear a bit more on that in a second. Fears that plans being discussed by Durham University could in effect scrap its college system, causing a little bit of concern among student representatives and college heads. We'll hear a bit more from David on that. And the RAF, how was it for you? That's the title of our cover feature this week. It's pretty self-explanatory what that's all about. But first, Simon, the lead news story this week is by John Morgan, who's not with us today. It concerns the possible relaxings of rules for overseas students once they graduate.
This kind of stems or goes back to the kind of key reason that people attribute a lot of the downturn in student sort of demand from some countries, in particular India, I suppose, of students wanting to come and study in the UK, because in 2012, some new rules were brought in that basically kind of scrapped a visa scheme where students could effectively work after they graduated. And that was seen as, like, as I said, a main reason why a lot of students came to this country to study, and you know, as we've seen, the figures have shown sort of downturn in international students. Recent HESA figures showed the first recorded kind of drop in enrolments, in fact, from non-EU students. But there's been a couple of key developments really in the last sort of couple of weeks, in that the Treasury, or Danny Alexander in particular, hosted a meeting really of kind of leading sector figures to sort of kind of look at different ways of increasing recruitment of international students, how to sort of boost that recruitment, and other topics as well, like branch campuses, etc. And I suppose why that's significant is that for a long time in the coalition, the battle on international students has been between BIS, Business Innovation and Skills Department, and the Home Office, which obviously wants to clamp down on immigration. And there's a lot of to and fro in going on there. You know, Vince Cable and David Willetts always saying, well, we want more students to come here and study, it's good for universities. The Home Office saying, the Home Office official line, of course, being that they only want the brightest and best students to come here, and they want to weed out the abuse of the visa system. So they've clamped down on the numbers of students coming, really, but they say it's only affected kind of the smaller sort of private colleges and ones where they don't think there were students were abusing the system. So that's interesting. But what's happened at this meeting? There was kind of a hint of talking about changing the rules so that you could allow people to study after graduation if they've come to the country on visas. Possibly in STEM subjects, but we've also heard from our contacts as well that the government is considering doing this for kind of maybe a set of universities, maybe a smaller set of the Russell Group. But then there's suggestions that other people from other people in government, they prefer it to be the Russell Group and more research intensives. So there's definitely a debate going in within government of whether to relax these rules.
And it could turn to be quite divisive as well if it is certain
institutions and universities and others, then it would be, yeah, exactly. Then, you know, it obviously drives a bit of a wedge in the sector, will upset some universities, I think, if that was to happen.
I suppose throughout this whole debate, it's been shaped by this immigration target by, you know, the next year's election to net immigration down below 100,000 a year. I suppose what kind of could open up an opportunity for this is actually if this were introduced next year, post-study work visas come back, it wouldn't actually have any effect on immigration numbers by the time of the election. I mean, it's pretty unlikely it's going to come in 2014-15, because I suppose universities are already recruiting for that because the students will come in September.
Yeah.
But if it, you know, obviously next September will be after the election, and we don't really know what the policy is going to be on net migration after the election. So yeah. I guess that opens a bit of a window of opportunity.
Yeah, no, true. I suppose the key thing might be, you know, say there was a Conservative government next time around, what their policy would be, you know, whether they'll go into a manifesto with that same kind of pledge, really, and how they frame, you know, because obviously immigration is still a huge, you know, topic when it comes to votes. So they're going to have each party will want a policy that kind of addresses that issue and fits in, because that's always been the difficulty with this policy, is that, you know, a lot of people criticise the government for not helping universities in attracting international students, but I suppose they're all hamstrung, really, all the politicians, because at the end of the day, polls are consistently showing anti-immigration feeling amongst the public. That's you know, that is the kind of situation that even Labour have had to kind of address that.
And Theresa May, perhaps typically quite hardline on the issue, seems to have the ear of the Prime Minister, certainly something that we've reported on before. But that's on page 6 this week for the full lowdown. Another headline on that page reads, Durham's colleges fear changes will downgrade them to halls of residence. David, this is one of yours.
Yes, so we've picked up a major concern in Durham over plans to sort of realter how colleges there deliver their services. So what's feared by junior common room student residents and also heads of colleges there is basically these changes mean that Durham's colleges will be halls of residence in all but name, basically. So one college head who didn't want to be named has said the very major legitimate concerns about the future of the Durham collegiate system, and they're trying to sort of make major changes to what's being proposed. So there's a sort of leaked briefing on the proposals, basically say that they're going to scrap college bursars and also the kind of budgets that colleges sort of used to manage will be managed by the sort of directors, the director of estate and their team, you know, on a university-wide basis. And also, I mean, the kind of catering and sort of support staff will still be assigned to one college, but they might have to work in other colleges at peak times, this briefing says. And the student representatives from the colleges, you know, fear that this will lead basically to them becoming halls of residence. And the university says, you know, denies that there's no plans to reorganise the collegiate system. All they're saying is that the colleges won't be responsible for managing service delivery. Is their take on it? And the kind of heads of colleges will have more time to focus on creating the colleges as a kind of scholarly communities and not, you know, having to deal with the kind of, you know, catering and all the kind of
why is that day-to-day. I've not read the article. Is that just a cost-saving thing? It would make more sense for Durham to buy these services en masse?
That's the idea. I mean, they say that why are they necessary? The document says current line management structures were limiting the university's ability to achieve service improvements and value for money. I mean, I think what might be going on here is that they're worried that colleges provide very different levels of service for students. That's sort of what the document seems to imply, that they have sort of minimum service standards for every college. I mean, it's a really interesting one, because universities are now trying to, you know, they're trying to carve out their kind of niche and become distinctive to students as they compete for them. And obviously Durham's college system is quite a draw, I think, for many students. It's quite widely promoted on their website.
In fact, people are typically very proud of their own college as well.
Yeah,
like that sort of close, that smaller community within a large community, I imagine, is quite a strong selling
point. Yeah, exactly. And they're actually hosting a conference later this year on universities with colleges. It's a difficult one, because if you're a student, I mean, do you care if your college services are managed by a central university? I mean, I suppose what will stay is having college sports teams, student representation, that kind of thing. I wonder whether that's more
important.
Do people
feel proud of their own caterers?
Well,
proud of their own administrator. Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, clearly the student bodies and the colleges do seem to be very concerned about this. And it's important to note, I mean, you know, the sort of classic college model is in Oxford and Cambridge, but it's important to note, I think, that even before these changes, Durham colleges aren't, they're not really they don't really have the same powers. They don't control admissions, they don't control teaching, and they don't have these enormous endowments that some, I don't think they have anyway, these enormous endowments that Oxbridge colleges have, which basically make them financially independent. So it's a slightly different system anyway, but it looks like it might be homogenised further.
Mm, and from the small college system to a very different setup, the Open University, you had a story this week on their vice-chancellor. He's been advertising for a new employee.
Yeah, we were surprised to see this advert pop up on Twitter, actually, for a speechwriter for the vice-chancellor of the Open University, Martin Bean. So it's a replacement for his current speechwriter, which is the first to replace the first person who had this position. I guess we didn't realise that any vice chancellors had speechwriters. It seems to be slightly
full time speechwriter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's unique in the UK. We don't seem to have seen any other adverts for speechwriters. But it is. I mean, is it a kind of sign that vice chancellors are becoming more like, you know, as it says in the piece, like, you know, like the kind of president in the West Wing with these huge sort of entourages around them? I mean, they've already got kind of policy wonks and, you know, and various other people to advise them, kind of, you know, henchmen or, you know, people that they sort of, you know, senior eyes, that kind of thing.
And I mean, press officers apart from anything else,
yeah,
as well.
Exactly. So is the speechwriter going to become another fixture in the sort of vice chancellor's office?
Might
make some of their conference presentations more lively anyway. Or is that too cynical?
Maybe so. Well, Paul, we haven't got you here to be cynical about vice-chancellor's presenting skills, although that's always welcome. You wrote our cover feature this week. It's all about, well, when you're with us, it's invariably about the ref. And you've been sort of rounding up what happened during the inaugural Research Excellence Framework.
I have, yeah, and it turns out that the ref is not only a cross that bears heavily on my back.
You sounded like a man weary of writing stories about the Research Excellence Framework. I could not understand how that possibly could be the case.
No, absolutely. But, it seems everyone else is up to their necks in it as well. Basically, I did a survey of heads of research, university heads of research, about how the submission process had gone for them. And, you know, the first question I asked was whether the workload involved had been less than in 2008. Because, of course, the RAF was originally billed as a much lighter touch exercise. Gordon Brown wanted it to be just sort of metrics driven and that it would be vastly cheaper and easier to run, but it turns out that hasn't been the case. Quite the opposite, in fact. I mean, one head of research reckoned that it would have been three or four times more burdensome than 2008 RAE, and everyone else said it had been at least as difficult. The reason, of course, is that the impact agenda, which was introduced to it in order to get Gordon Brown to agree to drop the metrics, so it was a sort of necessary evil, but because it was a first time around for the impact criteria, everyone seems to have made quite heavy weather of getting their heads around it. Mm. Obviously the stakes were pretty high, so people would have felt the need to really do that before they made their submissions.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece, and I know for a fact that it will be one of the most read articles from this week's magazine. It certainly always seems to sort of capture people's attention. It's got everything. It's got people feeling like they're jumping through hoops for reasons they don't want to. We've got pressure from the university to perform well.
I was just going to say that it's probably also worth mentioning. I asked 16 questions in total. Obviously, we're not going to get through all of them. But one other one was whether they had any suggestions for future RAFs. So some of the answers there were quite interesting. Mm-hmm. One said, scrap it. A bit predictable, but there it is. Another suggested that just like heads of research have to sort of stand by the judgments they make in terms of who to submit and who not, that sort of Hefke should be sort of subjected to the same spotlight, in the sense that the grading decisions they make for each individual ought to be publicised and ought to be open to scrutiny, so that if they sort of make a cock up, they ought to be as accountable for it as
a ref for the ref
as the heads of research are.
I mean, I suppose that, you know, what's the sort of ultimate purpose of the REF? Is it is to sort of distribute money to good research, basically, isn't it?
Well, that's but the official reason.
Yeah.
But you know, the unofficial reason is to make the case to government that the university research is worth funding.
I suppose in that light, it's quite concerning that I think about a third of the respondents to our best university workplace survey said it damaged their research, which I suppose is the opposite of what it's ultimately supposed to do, which is to encourage good research.
Yeah, well, people say that, but then others will point to the, you know, you look at the period that the REF has been, well, the REE has been running for since the mid-80s, basically. And during that time, you know, the quality of UK research, by all measures, limited though they are, has gone through the roof, you know, in terms of citations per paper and citations per individual and that kind of thing. So, you know, if you look at it in that way, people may perceive that the RE has this negative effect on research, but whether that's actually true is another matter.
Indeed. Well, that's on page 34 this week. The Best University Workplace Survey is available online, of course. That's all for this week's issue review. If you want to comment on anything in the magazine, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, even on Google+. Of course, you can visit us at timeshighereducation.co.uk as well. But until next time, that's the end of the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.